welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers and the literary arts in Astoria and the Lower Columbia region. I'm your host, Marianne Monson. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. What motivates writers to do the work they do, and what have they learned through their creative process? This month for River Writers, we are airing a segment of the show that was recorded by KMUN with Carl Marlantes at the Liberty Theater for as part of the Creative Writing Festival in October 2024. So please enjoy this conversation with Carl Marlantes.
Carl Marlantes is a graduate of Yale University and a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. He served as a Marine in Vietnam, where he was awarded the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, 2 Navy Commendation Medals for Valor, 2 Purple Hearts, and 10 Air Medals. He is the author of Matterhorn, which won the William E. Colby Award given by the Pritzker Military Library, the Center for Fiction's Flaherty Dunnan First Novel Prize, the 2011 Indies Choice Award for Adult Debut Book of the Year, and the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's James Webb Award for Distinguished Fiction. Subsequent books include Deep River, a novel about the Finnish immigrants who settled the Lower Columbia, What It's Like to Go to War, and his latest, Cold Victory. Carl lives in rural Washington. Please join me in welcoming Carl Marlantes.
Thank you. Is this working okay? All right. Yes, it's so wonderful to be here. Some of you know, but I was born about 2 blocks from here, St. Mary's Hospital. And there was a wooden wing of that, and I think that's been gone, but the bricks are still there. And I have some relationship with this theater because my mother left high school, Astoria High School, when she was 14 and got a job as an usher right here. And she also sold tickets, and they were hard in those days. They had to count at the end, she said, every time that the night was over. And if the money didn't add up to what the tickets were, they came out of your wages. And so she and the other girls had this sort of, which is not, it's kind of cruel, but then, you know, this is like the early 30s maybe. There were so many foreign seamen coming in here who didn't speak English and didn't understand our money system. So they would always shortchange these poor sailors just in case the tickets didn't add up at the end of the. So anyway, that was a little bit of Astoria history. I was born here, but then grew up in Seaside and went to Seaside High School. And grew up in this family that some of you were just at this thing up here in Long Beach Peninsula that I told this story. I'm sorry, I'm not a politician. I have to tell the same story every time I come out, you know, because it doesn't change. My mother is a Finnish speaker. She was born in Brix's logging camp, which is right across the river here. And she didn't speak English until she went to grade school in Deep River. And then she had to start learning English. And my father, who is Greek, that's where the Marlantes comes from, is his same thing. He grew up in a Greek-speaking family and didn't speak English until he was about 5 or 6 as well. And of course, my grandmother, who lived here in Astoria, spoke Finnish, but she was married to a Norwegian, Leif Erikson, and I always thought that they named this road after him, you know. But and then Grandma got divorced and married a Swede, so if you could imagine this, we've got Greek and we've got Swedish and Norwegian and Finnish and English. My older brother, one night after we had Thanksgiving dinner, he flopped on the bed and he said, "You know, Carl, we live in cultural linguistic schizophrenia." But it probably helped my writing because I love languages and I love words. And I thought that I would talk a little bit about motivation. Most of the people here, are writers. And people always ask me, why'd you write that? What made you write that? And there's sort of an overarching issue, and then there's each one for the specific books. Always wanted to write, I read all the time, Seaside Library then shared the building with the fire truck. I don't know if you remember that, but Mrs. Whitty, who was the librarian, took me under her arm, and she'd pump me full of books. Bookmobile would come down every 2 weeks, and that just was the way I spent childhood. Was reading a lot, and I tried my hand at writing, and one of the great failures was I decided to write a black mass, and my dad got a hold of it and he took me out to the backyard and I had to put it in the burning barrel and burn it up. I loved it. But the other thing that also had to do with the burning barrel is that when I was about seven or eight, I got a diary, an open diary for a Christmas present. And so I remember, writing in my diary, the first day was New Year's Day. And about, I was probably about 9 or 10. I thought, it'd be interesting to see what I wrote my first day in my diary. And it was burned into my head because went down to the pond. There was a mill pond around where we lived. There were no ducks, but there was a snake. That was it. From humble beginnings, but what hit me, it was a profound thing, is that was the first time I realized I would never see that day again. That was, writing sort of went past time, and I became like aware that I'm mortal and I'm going to die. It was a very profound experience. And it had to do with writing that passage. Went down to the pond. There were no ducks, but there was a snake. And I'll never see that day again. And it hit me, boom, just like that. And people who write, I often make the analogy. It's like, when Jimi Hendrix was given his guitar at age, 11, he slept with it, all right? And sometimes people come and say, Mary's really good at the piano, but she doesn't want to take piano lessons anymore. And should I force Mary to take piano lessons? I said, can Mary walk by the piano without touching it? Oh, sure she can. Don't give her lessons. It's like that with writing. You can't help yourself. You're always scratching something and thinking about something. And it's just part of your nature, I think. Of course, it has to get honed. There's a lot of people, I got a book in me. Yeah, everybody's got that, getting it out. Which reminds me of, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty random that way. If I have a woman who's a friend of mine who's a writer, and she was saying, she says, it is sort of like sex and having a baby. In the very beginning, it's just wonderful, and you're writing, and it's just really good. But in the end, you just want to get the damn thing out. So I always wrote and studied economics. I wanted to study English literature, but I remember one night just sitting there going, I can't make a living at this. And my older brother studied economics, and he did really well. He became the chairman of the board of Cushman and Wakefield. So, I thought, he wasn't then, but I could follow him. He, in fact, is the person behind Melis and Matterhorn. Melis is very good at sort of politics in the sense of power. My older brother was sort of the model for that. People say, was that you? And I go, you know, if it was me, I'd be the governor and a lot richer than I am. That's who inspired him. So I just had always wanted to do that, but I never studied it. I read literature and just always was reading. And I think, again, you writers, I heard an interview with Miles Davis. And if you think you're cool, you'll never be as cool as Miles Davis, you know. And anyway, someone asked him, how do you become a great jazz musician? And he looked at him and he said, listen, listen, listen. And that's the same with being a writer. Read, read, read. It goes into your soul, it goes into your head. It's the only way to do it. I mean, you can study stuff like how to develop characters. In fact, you have to. When I did the first draft of Matterhorn, I thought it was damned easy. I mean, I punched out 1,700 A4 pages because I was in Europe, and it was an Olympic electric typewriter. And I finished it, and I went off to Ireland with my girlfriend, and came back to read the great American novel. You know, I'm ready to go, and it was just crap. I mean, there were three or four pages on wet socks. And I thought, this is, maybe there's something more to this novel writing than I thought. And so then I started seriously studying it. One of the things that some people are surprised by is I took Louis L'Amour and Danielle Steele, and I outlined their books. Not all of them, there's too many of those. But both of those people know how to make people turn pages, you know, and what is it? What do they do? And so I picked up, you know, up a tree, down a tree sort of plots from just outlining some other works. And I started reading now with an eye toward, so why did Tolstoy do it that way? I mean, Tolstoy could make a character out of a horse in a paragraph. You know, how does he do that? You know, well, he does it with a specific detail. Oh, I see, okay. So reading with an eye toward how do they do that is something that I've found very useful. What motivated me about Matterhorn, obviously I was in the Marine Corps and served in basically up in the mountains of Vietnam in Northern I Corps. And you heard the bio. I came back and I, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to write the great American novel about the Vietnam War, and I told you how that worked out. And someone once asked me, well, why do you keep at it? It took 35 years before I got it published. And there are some gifts from the garbage because my characters got better and better because I kept working at it. I mean, I kept trying to sell it. I mean, I never counted them. I just started throwing the rejection slips away, but someone asked me once, what motivated you to keep going? And I had never really thought about it. You know, I mean, I'm just a damn fool. You know, that might be it. There were times I would literally go down to some bookstore at 9 o'clock at night and look at the pick novels off the shelf and go, I'm as good as this person. Why don't they publish me? You know, I mean, so hang in there. You'll get there. But I thought, you know, what did keep it to me? And there's two incidents that are important to what motivated me about keeping at Matterhorn. The first one, and again, I apologize if some of you have heard this story because I can't change it, is that I had come back from Vietnam, and I was pretty much a mess. But I was working at Headquarters Marine Corps, which is, and I was assigned at the Pentagon, and I had to take some papers to the White House, and so I had the briefcase with the lock on it and everything, you know, so like they see in the movies. But I thought, well, I'm going to the White House, so I got all spiffed up and put my ribbons on and shine my shoes, and I'm walking down just outside of the White House, and a group of students were across the street waving North Vietnamese flags and jeering me and calling me names. And I was just stunned. I had just gotten back about, you know, 6 or 7 weeks before, and my friends were still over there fighting. And they were, you know, the whole sort of baby killer thing, and I was just stunned, and I wanted to shout at them or tell them or talk to them and say, you know, the people you're calling baby killers, they're 18. They're way younger than you are. But the only reason that they're over there and you're here is because you get to go to college, and they didn't.
For those of you who are just joining us, this is Marianne Monson for KMUN's River Writers, sponsored by the Writers Guild. This morning, we are airing a segment of show from October 2024 and the Creative Writing Festival at the Liberty Theater, where author Carl Marlantes was speaking about his work.
And I thought, but if I walk across the street to try and talk to these kids, I mean, it would just explode. Marine attacks students on Washington Street. I mean, you know, I couldn't do anything. I was in uniform. I couldn't do anything except listen to it. And people walking by, nobody coming to my aid or anything. And I just wanted to tell my story and our story. And it was sort of finally just, you know, walk across that street and tell them, here is what it's like. Here's what it's like to be 18, trying to grow up and fighting in a war that, quite frankly, doesn't make any sense. And, you know, they're just like you, except they didn't get to go to college. I wanted to tell our story. And the other incident, which was very much same kind of a motivator, is I was very enamored with this girl. She was studying D.H. Lawrence, which I thought was very sexy, you know. And she was getting a master's in it. And so we had had a couple of dates, and I finally thought, well, maybe I should tell her that, you know, I'm a Vietnam veteran and I was a Marine. And so we're down at the bottom of the stairs that led up to her flat, and I say, well, you know, I just got back from Vietnam about a year ago, and I was a Marine. And she recoiled. She was sitting on the stairs, and she stood up, and she said, oh, my God, they're the worst. And she went up the stairs, and I never saw her again. And Matterhorn is just trying to shout up the stairs. You know, here we are. This is who, hello, you know. And so this need to communicate is a big part of Matterhorn. And there's also the part trying to get it out of my system. But the second book, which was What It Is Like to Go to War, was very much more specifically motivated by trying to get my life together. I had killed somebody up really, really up front and personal, a young Vietnamese soldier, and in combat, you normally don't actually make any sort of connection with the people. I mean, quite often you don't even see them. There's fire coming from the, you know, tree line or something, and you fire back and people die, and you don't even see them lots of times. But in this one particular incident, which I talk about in this second book, I crawled up to a position where this kid was throwing grenades at my group. And he looked at me, and he had a grenade in his hand. And I looked at him, and he was no further away from me than the front row here. We actually locked eyes, and that's really very rare. And I remember whispering to him, don't throw it. I won't kill you. Don't throw it. If you don't throw that grenade, I won't kill you. I won't shoot. But, I mean, I didn't know Vietnamese. He didn't know English. And he snarled at me and threw it, and I got hit with all the shrapnel, and I shot him right through the head. And okay, fine, you know, I'm busy, I have to get organized for the counterattack, and the war goes on, and I didn't think anything of it until the early 90s, and I had not thought anything of it. And I'm driving up I-5, and it's the middle of the night, and I have 5 kids, and I was away from the kids. It's like, yay, country music, I can listen to what I want. And 2 a.m, and I'm driving up, and all of a sudden I see these 2 eyes in the windshield. And I went, you know, I'm sophisticated enough to know, like, okay, that's not a ghost. That's something that you got to deal with. The two eyes were looking at me in the windshield. And that's what motivated me to write that second book. I had to start turning these ghosts, and those are ghosts, into some kind of ancestors. And a friend of mine, Joe Bobro, actually coined that. He said, Carl, he says, you know, you're turning your ghosts into ancestors with this book. He says, ghosts haunt you, and they're unconscious. And the ghosts are what get you into bar fights. They're what get you into drugs. The ghosts ruin your marriages. You'll never get rid of those experiences. And those of you who have had, you know, experiences that are of a tougher nature, whatever they are, you'll never go away. That's part of you. That's who it is. That's you. You got to just get them so they don't haunt you. And so I started writing so that this ghost would come out and I would get it in front of me. And it doesn't have to be writing. It can be music. It can be just talking to your spouse. There's a lot of ways to get this unconscious, haunting ghosts out in front of you. So then they become ancestors and they don't drive you crazy or get you in trouble. So what it is like to go to war was basically dealing with that. And all the things about war, including the fact that, you know, you give a 19-year-old the role of God. Well, 19-year-olds don't deal well with becoming God. But that's what our government does. And it's like they make decisions about life and death. They make horrible, difficult decisions. A corpsman that I know, there was a wounded NVA soldier, terribly wounded. We had to move. We had to get out of there because there's other danger coming. We didn't. And is he going to die? I mean, we can't take him prisoner. I mean, what are we going to do with him? I don't know. You know, it was that kind of a dilemma. And he said, he was 20 years old. He said, he's going to die. And he walked over and shot him. And he did it out of mercy. I mean, it wasn't like he's one of these cold-blooded killers. This guy was a corpsman who really, really was there basically to save lives. But what do you do when someone's in such terrible pain and there's no way out? And there were tigers. And tigers, we lost a guy to tigers. I mean, they ate him because there was a lot of dead bodies around. And so I'm going like, you know, that... A kid who's 20 shouldn't have to be making decisions like that, but they do, and they have to come back with them and carry them. And so this book that I wrote dealt with things like that, the spiritual side of combat, the lying of combat, the fear and all that stuff. And what it did is it got my ghosts out. And I have to admit, there were times that there would literally would be snot on the keyboard. I mean, I'd be just bawling my head off. And I go, oh, God, this is terrible. And wipe it up and then I'll keep going. And it was a very important book for me that way. Deep River is obviously it's a book about my half of my family heritage, my Finnish side. And my grandmother, who is kind of a, I don't know what you call it, an inspiration for Aino, the principal female character in the novel. She's nowhere near as active in the IWW and all that sort of stuff that I made Aino. But she was in the IWW, my grandmother. And this is one of those things that's like when you just tuck it away. If you're a writer, you tuck it away. I came home from college, and some of you are of a certain age. You might remember Joan Baez singing the song about, I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. And I thought, wow, that's great, Joe Hill, yeah. So I come home and I go up to Grandma and I say, Grandma, I said, did you know Joe Hill, you know, when you were in the IWW? And she literally took a step back. That son of a bitch. I was like, Grandma, he's a left wing icon. He's a, you know, I mean, come on, what's going on? And she told me the story. She said they were, you know, she was helped organize. She, you know, she fed organizers, and she was a solid IWW union member. And she said that the deal was you had to get them to try and carry the card. That was a red card, and pay their union dues, because these organizers have to eat. And it was really hard, because if you got caught with an IWW card, you were fired. And not only that, you were blacklisted. You couldn't find a job anywhere in the lower Columbia area. And you'd have to move yourself and your family someplace else. I mean, it was a very serious, scary thing to be caught carrying the IWW card. And she said that she would work several years recruiting people, trying to get them to join the union. And then she said, that son of a bitch, he'd show up from some city like Portland, and he'd come to make a big rally, all kinds of songs. There'd be cops standing all around, all over the place, and he'd sing his songs, and he'd leave, and all that would be left was a bunch of torn up IWW cards. I went, wow, that's a different view of Joe Hill, you know? And Joe Hill did have clay feet. I mean, he was an incredible, iconic IWW singer, and wrote parodies, and it was important for the movement. But he also, you know, I think that, as far as I can tell, he really did murder somebody in Salt Lake City, and kind of womanizer. Well, he obviously, you know, I had to put him in the novel because of that story. And the other thing that was motivating me is I woke up one morning about 4 a.m. with an image of my grandmother looking out. She has a house that has a plate glass window that looks out on the river, the Columbia River. And I remember seeing her one time just looking out the river. And I woke up with this image of her looking out the river. And I'm thinking, what a life she led. I mean, she was born in 1889, and she watched people go to the moon. I mean, she grew up with, there were no cars, there was no electricity, and she watched people go to the moon. That's an amazing life. And I was thinking, wow, that's something. That should, you know. Well, time goes on, and I haven't done anything about a book or anything, but I have images in my head. And I went back to Oxford when I was older. I had, by that time, 4 kids. And the one thing is, if you get a degree from Oxford, you can always go there and audit any class for free if you get permission from the lecturer or seminar leader. And they had a course there that I think only possible in Oxford called Old Norse Poetic Diction. And it was, believe it or not, it was the woman who ran it, Emily Dronke, was the Sigmundsson professor of ancient Icelandic antiquities. And I was the only person in that class that didn't speak 3 dead languages. And I started getting into the Norse sagas. And I started thinking, wow, you know, I could write a book. Like, there was a particular saga called Laxdala Saga, and it's about a village in Iceland that was founded by, you know, Vikings. And it's the story of that village. It's called Laxdala Saga. And I thought, well, I could just transfer Laxdala Saga to Astoria or something. That'd be really cool. That'd be really neat. And then I got into the Kalevala. And those of you who are Finnish background, it's a national epic of Finland, very important to Finnish identity.
Thank you for joining us today on River Writers, and thanks to Carl Marlantes, who joined us for the Astoria Creative Writing Festival in October 2024. The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting the literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more and become a member by visiting thewritersguild.org. Until next time, keep the words flowing and your pencil sharp. I'm Marianne Monson for River Writers.